Well, ALMA is the largest and most sensitive millimeter wave telescope ever conceived. And we're going to be talking about astronomy and ALMA today. It's the Atacama Large Millimeter Array is the name of it. And Ed Churchill, professor of astronomy in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, our guest today to talk with us about it, fill us in on the details, and certainly answer your questions as we move along today. And I hope you'll join us when you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 as we talk astronomy in ALMA today with Ed Churchill. Ed, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us today. Really appreciate it. What is this? Well, this is quite the engineering marvel, isn't it?
Well, it's an amazing facility, actually. It's, as I said, as you said, it's the probably the, well, not probably, it's the largest radio facility that's ever been conceived so far. And it's also will be located on a very strange side. I mean, it's at 16,500 feet in the Chilean Andes in the northern part of Chile. And it will be composed of a total of 66 different antennae, 50 of which will be in the working array. These will be 50 12-meter telescopes, and then there will be an addition of 12 7-meter telescopes. And they'll all be connected electrically, and so, you know, you may ask, well, why separate telescopes?
Yeah.
And the reason is this operates very much like a zoom lens.
Oh.
Each telescope is movable. And there's a big truck. We have two trucks, actually, that will just slip under each telescope, pick it up, move it to a different side. And so the configuration of all of these antennae together will be continuously changing. And if you move the telescopes further apart, what happens is that you're zooming in on the sky, so your resolution increases, and but the area of the sky that you actually observe is small. The field of view is smaller as you increase the size of the antenna, but the resolution increases, and so when all these telescopes are operating together, you're going to have a very, very powerful telescope, because the more telescopes you have, the more sensitive the instrument is, and also what we call, the astronomers refer to, the faster it is. That is, it can image a piece of sky much more quickly with 50 antennae than it can with, let's say, two or three. You could do it with two or three, but you won't go as deep, and it would take you forever to make a picture.
Wow. Well, who was the brainchild, brother? A lot of people you were involved in. A lot of people involved in this.
Well, that's kind of an interesting story. It started out as a completely American project, and it at that time it was called the Millimeter Array. The MMA is what it was referred to. And I served on the science advisory committee for that, and in fact was the chair of that committee for 3 years until it became an international project. And so at that time, it was going to be 30 telescopes, and we hadn't really fully decided how big each telescope would be. And then, what was it? Maybe... I've forgotten exactly the date, but in the late 90s, it became an international project. The Europeans got wind of this and decided that this was a great idea. They'd like to be a part of it. And so it became an international project at that time. And the what's called the European Southern Observatory, which is a consortium of European countries, including England, France, Germany, Holland, Sweden, Italy, and I think maybe even Spain is a member of that. Anyway, it's a consortium of European countries that have gone together and will be members of this. And then, of course, the Japanese heard about this, and they got interested. And so then the Japanese wanted, you know, their share of this project. So at the moment, I think it's more or less a 30-30-30 split between these three consortia, plus a little bit of time for Chile, because Chile is providing the space for it, the location, and they've set up what they call a scientific preserve. It's protected for this project. And, of course, I think a lot of other facilities may join because it's hard to find scientific preserves that's preserved really just for science.
Just for science. How large an area are we talking about?
Well, surprisingly, this is a very large plain, and it's the AMA will be, I think, have a diameter of about 10 kilometers.
Oh.
Okay. And
about 6 miles, roughly.
Roughly that, yeah, about 6 miles. And there are been discussions of expanding this to about 30 kilometers. So this is a very unusual place because it's so high and reasonably flat over a large area.
And have you been there? You've been there, haven't you?
Believe it or not, I haven't. I've done a lot of work for this project. I've never gone there, but I've seen, you know, many pictures and so forth. Yeah.
So why? The question, of course, would be why do we need an AMA?
That is a good question. And one, why do we need an AMA and why do we need such an expensive one? And with AMA, the reason AMA is so critically important is because of the wavelength range that it's observing at. It's it operates from a wavelength of about 7 millimeters, are those who are familiar with frequencies, about 35 gigahertz or so, up to about 950 gigahertz, or about 0.3 millimeters. So it operates over a span of about a factor of 20 in wavelength. And those wavelengths are particularly difficult to observe from the surface of the Earth. And that's because the atmosphere is fairly opaque at these high frequencies. And there are a few bands that where the atmosphere has reasonable transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And so the AMA, in fact, will have 9 different types of receivers that will span this whole wavelength interval. At every region where the atmosphere is reasonably transparent, we'll have a receiver there. And these receivers are very special receivers. They're one of a kind, and what's important in astronomy is the low noise receivers. That is, mm-hmm. receivers that have very little electrical noise that they generate themselves. And so these receivers will work almost at what's called the quantum limit, the theoretically lowest noise you can receive from an electrical mm-hmm. system. And so it's those frequencies that's important.
And you mentioned a high cost. I'm sure it's expensive process.
Well, I'm a little embarrassed to say what the total cost of this system is. It's about $1.2 billion. But, of course, that's now split 3 ways.
Yeah.
So the U.S. side of this is a few hundred million. So it's still within our reach. But these projects are getting so big that a single country nowadays can't really pull it off.
And, frankly, it's probably, although I know there can be problems cooperating, with cooperation among other countries, is probably a good thing.
It is a good thing, actually. It's taken us a little while to learn how to cooperate on collaborate on a large project like this, and it makes decisions much more difficult, of course, because you have many different voices that have different ideas about things. So it has some a certain amount of frustration associated with it, but in the end, usually sensible decisions are made.
Yeah,
but well, slower.
Well, now, what is it that we are? Are we wanting to look at with this? I mean, do we want to turn our attention to a closer look at Saturn, or is it something different?
Well, this facility is a very flexible system. It will actually contribute to a lot of fundamental problems in astronomy. So there are people who are interested in planetary science will be happy to get time on this telescope. People who are looking at little asteroids in our solar system, for example, if you're concerned about asteroids that might possibly collide with the Earth and so forth,
mm-hmm.
the system will be very good for detecting those at quite large distances. But its real strength, I think, is going to come in at greater distances. People who are interested in star formation, for example, believe it or not, the sky is full of stars, but we have we have a concept, but we don't really understand how stars are made. And this facility will, I think, is going to revolutionize our ideas about star formation. But it also will contribute to cosmology, some of the large-scale mm-hmm. problems having to deal with the universe as a whole. So, as I say, this is a very flexible facility that I think will contribute to the whole sweep of astronomy, actually.
Ed Churchwell, our guest today, professor of astronomy in the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, as we talk with him about astronomy and about something called ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Atacama, by the way, stands for?
Well, Atacama is the name of this high plateau.
Yeah.
And it's probably the closest thing to a Martian landscape that you'll ever find on the surface of the Earth. Nothing grows there.
Nothing grows there. No. And what's the weather like? I mean, is it
believe it or not? That's the curious thing about this. You measure the amount of precipitable water in millimeters per year, so there's almost no precipitation there, and the skies are generally crystal clear. And what's critical for us is the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. That's what makes the atmosphere opaque and mostly. At these wavelengths. And so that's why if you go higher up, there's less water in the atmosphere because it's colder and can't carry as much water. As I say, it's just a clear location. So it's a perfect site for millimeter wave astronomy. The only place that's probably better would be the South Pole.
It's a little colder there.
It's a lot colder.
It's a lot colder there. All right. Well, Ed Churchwell, our guest today, and we've got a number of callers coming online to visit with him. And you'll be able to join us, too, here. News coming up, though, for a few minutes on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. In about the sixth week of my bout with pneumonia, and I'm finally feeling a little better, but my voice will sound a little scratchy from time to time. And fortunately, I'm not the person who has to do most of the talking. The person right now who has to do most of the talking is Ed Churchwell, who is professor of astronomy at the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy, and he's closely connected to the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, or ALMA. It's the largest and most sensitive millimeter wave telescope ever conceived. And we have some callers online with some questions. You may have some, too, as we talk astronomy and ALMA with him. The number 1-800-642-1234. Or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. And we'll be back with Ed right after this look at the news. Talking about space now and how we look at it and a new piece. I don't know. I can't say a new piece of equipment. I mean, it's many new pieces of equipment put together to form something called ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's the largest, most sensitive millimeter wave telescope ever conceived. Ed Churchwell has been intimately involved with the planning for this, and the construction, I believe, is underway. Isn't it, Ed?
Oh, yeah, it is, certainly. I think we already have about 8 antennae on site.
Yeah, and so you can join in with your questions as we visit with him at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And a couple callers online right now, Gay and Teddy. Let's go to Gay first in Madison. Hi, Gay.
Hi there. I want you to forgive me as a scientist if this is insulting, but my question is about the headline, the really, pardon me, butt-puckering headline about the super collider ending all life on Earth as we know it, that was current about a week ago and scared a lot of people. I'm wondering what's your opinion and if you think it's valid to have a little bit of fear because, you know, scientists tell us, trust us, we're scientists. We don't think it will end all life on Earth.
All right.
Well, okay. I think that article, actually, the fear was that it might produce a black hole, and which would then swallow up the Earth or something along those lines. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that's what it was.
And let me just say that producing a black hole is an exceedingly, exceedingly difficult thing to do. And even if this thing could produce a black hole, it would have such small amount of mass that it's not going to do any damage at all to the Earth. It seems to me like it's kind of scare tactics more than anything else. That article, I was aghast when I read it, because I can't simply conceive from physical. The way that the universe works, as I understand it, how they're ever going to produce a black hole. So,
it's something that you're not worried about.
I'm certainly not worried about it. No.
Well, what about the any problems associated with your telescopes that you're putting together here?
No problems. I mean, there are a lot of technical problems, and these telescopes will be among the most precise telescopes have ever been built. At these short wavelengths, the telescopes have to be very, very precise. The surface has to be very, very smooth, because typically the smoothness of the surface has to be at least about a tenth or smaller than the shortest wavelength that you wish to observe at. And so we're observing on the shortest wavelength at about 0.3 millimeters. So that means that the surface roughness of these telescopes have to be at least a tenth of that or smaller.
Wow.
And so there are all kinds of electronic thing called metrology and so forth built into these telescopes to keep them, for example, from being buffeted too much by wind, but to have temperature control. Temperature sensors all around the surface of the telescope, and then the backup structure and everything. So it's a very technically, they're very complicated telescopes, and that's why they cost so much. I mean, we're pushing technology here, and going to these high frequencies or short wavelengths costs you something. But so you have to ask, well, you know, what do we gain by this?
Yeah.
And what we gain is a look at a lot of processes that that otherwise you would not be aware of, because each wavelength range that we see in the electromagnetic spectrum tells us something different about physical processes that are going on. And for example, at millimeter waves where this telescope will operate, there are many, many molecules in the interstellar space that radiate at these wavelengths. And so there's, for example, then this opens up interstellar chemistry in a way that we've not been able to do so far. We know there are a lot of molecules out there. We've observed them. But at usually high expense in terms of telescope time, this thing will tick off molecules, you know, very quickly. So it's going to open up interstellar chemistry, for example.
Gay, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And Teddy in Milwaukee's up next. Hi, Teddy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I think I have two questions here. I originally was one, but my first question is, we've had the Hubble telescope, and, you know, given with all the flaws originally, we still know that it did some very valuable things and probably is still capable of doing some more great things. But conceivably, would it be possible to take this ALMA project and move it, say, where Hubble is positioned, or maybe further out, to give us an even better view of the universe? And that's my first question. My second question is, if we could do that, would it be possible to see planets up close in a way that maybe we wouldn't have to risk sending men or people there to visit? And would the optics, would they be strong enough to give us that view of, say, the ground, the dirt, and things of that nature?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's take the first question first. it would be great if we could actually move ALMA actually into space. The problem, I think, would be the expense of getting that much. I mean, we're talking about things that are, you know, each of these telescopes are you know, tens of tons of material or mass. And so to get them into orbit around the Earth would be, you know, it would be more expensive than the, you know, we could
$1 trillion
do.
level.
Or more.
More than a trillion.
More, yeah. And so what ultimately what one would like to do is to...
Could we get all the nations to just ante up?
Well, we've got a good fraction of them already anted up for the ALMA project. What you'd really like to do, I think, was go one better and put something like this on the backside of the moon. There you have the surface stability that you need. You have the, you know, you can still get your high spatial resolution and your high sensitivity and your mobility to be able to zoom in or out on an object. So that, I think, would be the sort of thing that we would really ultimately like to do. And a lot of the materials you can, in fact, get from the surface of the moon. And the moon has pretty much a similar composition to the crust of the Earth. And so that, I think, would be the better way to go. Now, let me just say that one of the key things I've not really mentioned about the ALMA project is that it will have exceedingly high spatial resolution. That what that means is that, for example, we'll be able to get a resolution of something like 6 milliarc seconds. So this is 6 times 10 to the minus 3, 6 thousandths of a second of arc. Now, let me give you an idea of what a second of arc really is like. If you take a quarter... And if you take it a distance of about 3 miles away, it would have the angular size of that quarter would be about 1 second of arc. Now, we're talking about, for ALMA, it's going to be able to get 6 milliseconds, so 6 thousandths of a second of arc. So this is the sort of thing, if thinking about it from this point of view, you could take ALMA and let's say look on the surface of, let's take a satellite Uranus, mm-hmm. You know, kind of resolve the clouds on Uranus, for example. Mm-hmm. So we have the possibility with ALMA to, for example, zoom in on the surface of Mars that we've been sending these Martian rovers to, and resolve rather small craters, for example, and large rocks. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be able to get a close-up view of the planets that we've only had by going there. Now, this will not, however, I think, make it unnecessary to go to there and actually take samples of the soil. You can't do a lot of chemistry of the soil and geology of the soil from a distance. But it's certainly going to give us a different way to study the planets than we've had up to now.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks, Teddy, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890 and email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'd love to hear from you. Talk about your work. What do you have in mind for your own research, and what are some of the research projects that are being considered?
Oh, yeah. Well, the area that I'm particularly interested in, I think it's going to almost going to make a big impact on, is star formation, particularly massive stars. And when I say massive stars, I mean stars that are 10 to 100 times as massive as the sun.
Oh.
And these stars are particularly problematic in terms of understanding them because they produce so much radiation as they start to accrete matter that the radiation pressure alone stops material from falling in to the star. And so that's one problem. The other problem is even if the radiation problem weren't there. As matter starts to fall in toward the center of a cloud, the cloud, if it had a tiny little bit of angular momentum or rotational motion, by the time a particle goes from way out at the edge of this cloud to the center or to the surface of the star as it's forming, it would its rotational motion would speed up so much because of conservation of angular momentum. It's the ice skater phenomenon yeah. where an ice skater puts their arms in and spins faster. Well, this happens to particles that are falling in toward the center of a cloud as well. And so you get to a thing called the centrifugal barrier where matter simply can't get any closer because it's rotating so rapidly that centrifugal force equals the gravitational force inward. And so it can't go in any further. And so you've got to find a way to get rid of this angular momentum in order to make the star. And this is true for all stars, but it's particularly true for massive stars. And nature has found a way to, of course, get around this. And we're just now beginning to understand a little bit about how it does that. The way nature does it now, we understand, is that it actually has jets that's throwing matter out in opposite directions from the spin axis or the poles of the star. But we don't really understand how those jets are driven. And this is the big problem in astronomy now, is to try to figure out how in the heck does nature figure out how to blow these jets out of the spin axis of the forming star.
And you'll be able to hopefully be able to figure that out.
Well, that's the thing. You see, we can with ALMA, we have this great resolution, so we can zoom in on this right on to the star itself and see what's going on there. I mean, how that star is actually driving material outward.
Interesting, Larry in Northwest Wisconsin. We'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi. I just had a quick comment about the cost of the telescope. It's really a good deal relative. It's always important to think of these things in relative terms. Quite a few years ago, our country built 20 B-2 bombers at the cost of over $2 billion, $2,000 million each, and for one single airplane, and nobody even raised an eyebrow. They hardly even knew the money was spent. So I think it's a good deal, and the more we can devote to pure research and the search for knowledge, it's just all positive.
I agree with you. $1 billion is a lot of money for science, of course, because we're not really the military.
Yeah.
And so it's a big investment for us. And one does have to be a little careful. There, you know, Congress does allocate money to science in somewhat smaller packets than they do the military. And as a consequence, we have to be a little bit careful that a large project like this doesn't stifle other science projects that are going on as well. And a few hundred million dollars, we're putting in something like I think it's probably going to be about $450 million before we're through from the U.S. side. And that's large enough that, other groups who are also planning creative science experiments, feel like they could be threatened a little bit by this. So there are issues like that. But I do agree.
It's a good deal.
Yeah, it's a good deal.
Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, Larry. Good to talk to you.
James in Milwaukee, we will turn to you next. Hi, James.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have a similar kind of question. I guess it's bad timing that mine comes right after the previous one because it takes a little bit of a different trajectory. And it's basically your guest had mentioned that he was embarrassed about the cost of this project. And, well, I can conjecture myself some reasons for why there would be some embarrassment about it. But I just wanted to ask him what is the source of his embarrassment? Is it maybe, like I think, perhaps because there are such other large pressing problems in the world like hunger and so forth that such an amount of money should be spent on this kind of project? Was that the source of his embarrassment, or is there some other source?
Well, for me personally, it is. We have a lot of social problems that are really pressing right now, and so one has to at least from my own conscience, I have to be able to justify spending this kind of money when I know there are people, even in the United States, who are hungry and homeless and all of this. So there are, we have to, at least from my standpoint, have to kind of balance our social needs and scientific needs. And this is an expensive project from, as I say, the point of view of the amount of money that's allocated. And so that's the origin of my embarrassment, I guess, is the way to put it.
And, there's the issue, there's always the issue of sort of pure science as opposed to, all right, we're working on a new Teflon or something.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, astronomy really, we're only in the knowledge business. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what's the value of new knowledge? Because we cannot argue that, we're really contributing anything back to the economy as such. We do contribute some things. I mean, I think some electronic circuits and cool detectors and things like that. A lot of, there are applications that is pushing technology. But I don't think we can argue that we're drivers of that by any means.
Yeah. Thanks, James, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, you started testing, or the system was tested, I think, 3 months ago? They started testing on sort of a limited basis because it's not all there. But
well, actually, testing started long before then. When the first two antennae were delivered, we had there are two antenna designs. There's one from the Europeans and one from the United States. And the idea originally was that we would compete these two designs against each other and then take the best parts of each design. That didn't work out, namely because there's big money involved here, and there are companies that want to build these antennae, and the Europeans wanted their share of these to be built in Europe, and of course we want our share to be built in the United States. And as a consequence, we have two separate designs, but both of them meet specs. But so we started testing the individual designs when the first ones
came aboard,
and the testing was done in Socorro, New Mexico, at the very large array on the plains of St. Augustine, and that testing started several years ago, actually, it takes a while to shake a complex telescope down like this to make sure it meets specs. We'll have about 25 European-designed antennae and about 25 American-designed antennae.
So the Japanese didn't get any designs in there?
The Japanese didn't, although they're providing 12 7-meter antennas, smaller antennae, and so that's their design.
Now, but these are going to be able to function together.
They'll all function together. Yeah, that's right. This isn't the first time this has happened. We have a facility called the CARMA, C-A-R-M-A, that's a wedding between a Caltech interferometer and an interferometer that's a consortium made up of Berkeley, University of Illinois, University of Maryland. I probably
left one out, maybe, but that's all right.
But anyway, they had very different designs, and they've just made a marriage between these and combined them all to one facility.
It
does work. I can confirm that it works. I've actually used that facility and it does work.
And what kind of an image do you wind up with then?
Well, that's the interesting thing. There's this whole theory of image reconstruction, so-called, where you take signals from many different telescopes and you combine them together. And you can – it's called aperture synthesis, actually, and you're synthesizing an image out of all this signals coming in from every telescope. And it's a fairly complicated thing that, it has to do with Fourier transforms and things like that.
Yeah.
But in the end, you get a picture that you can actually observe. You can put coordinates on it, and you get a picture at radio waves – which usually looks entirely different than a picture of the same region you would see optically or at X-rays or ultraviolet. As I say, at each wavelength band, you learn something, you know, different physical processes. And but in the end, you can get a picture you can actually look at.
And when will it be completely up and running?
Well, that's a good question. The plan is to start science operations when we get 16 antennae on the site that have been checked out and work.
Yeah.
And the target date for that is 2010. I think that's probably a little optimistic, but it's probably between 2010 and 2011. From that point on, there will be active science projects going on, even as construction is going on.
It's going on with the other.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Ed, thank you so much for being with us today. I look forward to getting an update on how things are going.
Well, it's my pleasure. I'd be glad to actually give you an update of some stuff that I've actually
been able to
observed,
do.
Right.
Ed Churchwell is a professor of astronomy. Excuse me, at the UW-Madison Department of Astronomy. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.